Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to explore strategies for the optimal management of excessive daytime sleepiness associated with obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy, and share insights and potential implications for clinical practice. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. In this first interview, Dr. Ayakovu outlines the importance of recognising excessive daytime sleepiness in people who are living with obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy, and provides practical guidance on how to meaningfully evaluate and determine the primary underlying cause.
Hello, my name is Dr. Anna Maria Ayakovu. I'm currently an assistant professor and attending physician in pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at Northwell Health in Lake Success, New York. Excessive daytime sleepiness is defined by the International Classification of Sleep Disorders as a complaint of sleepiness or the inability to maintain wakefulness when the patient intends to be awake. Up to 20% of people will complain of sleepiness. This can interfere with daytime function and is a very common complaint presented to healthcare providers, especially in the field of sleep medicine. Fatigue is characterized by the lack of energy, both physical and or mental, often described as the inability to initiate or maintain an activity, as well as difficulty with memory, concentration, and emotions. It is important to understand the difference between EDS and fatigue, as both can impact daytime function, quality of life, and can often be symptoms that denote different pathologies. EDS is a symptom that is reported in multiple sleep disorders, including obstructive sleep apnea and disorders of central hypersomnolence, including narcolepsy. The degree of sleepiness can vary from mild sleepiness, which is reported when sedentary or performing passive activities. Greater degrees of sleepiness can present with sleep attacks and intrusive sleep while performing activities such as driving, talking, and eating. EDS can impact various aspects of a patient's life, including the ability to function at work and socially. There are safety implications as well, including driving and the performance of complex tasks that require one to stay awake and alert. Quality of life may be impacted as excessive sleepiness can lead to a reduction in productivity and an ability to partake in activities. It is of utmost importance to recognize EDS in a timely manner. Assess the patient with a thorough history and physical examination and refer for objective testing, such as polysomnography and multiple sleep testing, latency testing as needed. So a thorough history is the first step in assessing EDS. Questions regarding sleep schedule and estimated total sleep time, as well as completion of sleep logs, may be required. The practitioner should inquire about neurodegenerative disorders, such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, myotonic dystrophy, as well as a history of brain lesions or head trauma. Other medical problems, including heart, kidney, and liver failure, rheumatologic and endocrinologic disorders such as hypothyroidism and diabetes may present with EDS. Psychiatric disorders must also be considered, as depression and bipolar disorder can present with EDS. A social history regarding substance use is also important. A patient should complete a screening tool such as an Epworth sleepiness scale, which is a self-administered questionnaire to determine the degree of sleepiness or chance of dozing in 8 scenarios of inactivity. A score of 10 or greater is considered to be abnormal and consistent with complaints of EDS. It is important to perform a medication reconciliation to assess the use of prescribed and over-the-counter medications that may be contributing to EDS. This includes the use of antipsychotics, antiepileptics, benzodiazepines, opioids, and sedating antidepressants. Supportive physical examination findings include drooping eyelids and yawning throughout the exam, as well as a crowded posterior oropharynx and a wide neck circumference. Routine metabolic workup is not always indicated. However, evaluation for anemia, thyroid disorders, vitamin deficiencies, and hepatic dysfunction may be considered. Effective patient and physician conversations should encourage the patient that further evaluation is likely to provide a diagnosis and treatment options for what can be very challenging and disabling symptoms to live with. Patient history is often key to differentiating various causes of EDS combined with objective data in the form of PSG and MSLT. History taking should focus on the typical signs and symptoms of OSA, such as snoring, witnessed apneas, multiple wake-ups, nocturia, morning headache, and a history of weight gain. Narcolepsy may also present with poor nocturnal sleep quality and unrefreshing sleep. However, other supporting qualities such as sleep attacks, sleep paralysis, hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, and cataplexy episodes help differentiate this from OSA. Prior to obtaining objective data with PSG-MSLT, the patient should establish a regular sleep schedule and provide sleep logs to allow for sufficient total sleep time, as sleep deprivation can contribute to inaccurate test results. Serial evaluation of EDS during initial and subsequent office visits with validated scales, such as the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, as well as the patient's perceived degree of EDS, is important to optimizing management. History taking is key to reevaluate the patient's specific needs, comorbidities, and life circumstances. For instance, in a patient with obstructive sleep apnea and comorbid Parkinson's disease, it is not uncommon for the patient to continue to describe sleepiness despite adequate treatment of both their illnesses. This must be assessed regularly during subsequent encounters with the patient and the treatment plan tailored to the patient's needs.
Thank you for your valuable insights, Dr. Ayakovu. Now let's move on to our next interview with Professor M. Zalem. She is going to discuss current treatment approaches and explore how the management of excessive daytime sleepiness may be optimized for people living with obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy.
Hello, my name is Helene M. Zalem. I'm the director of the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I'm a clinical professor of neurology at George Washington University. Obstructive sleep apnea and narcolepsy are both chronic disorders. Their management requires a multidisciplinary approach to taking care of the gross obvious symptoms as well as subtle symptoms that can interfere with patients' ability to function and optimize their day. There are guidelines for treatment that are available from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine for the management of central disorders of hypersomnia and obstructive sleep apnea, and they've been updated in the current COVID era as well. We have to focus on the desired outcome for the management of excessive daytime sleepiness in both of these disorders. First and foremost is to manage the sleepiness that occurs, but it's also critically important in the apnea patients to be sure that we've optimally managed the disordered breathing, checking the apnea plus hypopnea index, and ensuring that we've normalized oxygen saturations for the patient. After we've taken care of the obvious challenges, it becomes important to delve a little deeper and to investigate the patient's quality of life and determine if there are other factors that may need to be addressed. In patients with narcolepsy, we know that many of those patients feel that they are significantly improved and they're happy about that, but that they're not normalized. And in apnea, some patients are sufficiently relieved that they don't want to talk about residual symptoms at times. Important to think about are the cardiovascular outcomes. Patients with both narcolepsy and obstructive sleep apnea have higher risks of cardiac morbidity, and we have to think about the medications we use when we treat them and what the impact is on their overall symptoms and well-being. Weight loss becomes an important factor to consider when we have patients with either of these disorders. Interestingly, patients with narcolepsy have a higher risk of obesity. So when there is excess weight, trying to optimize alertness, optimize nocturnal sleep quality, and manage that becomes quite important. In the course of managing these patients, it's important to consider management of their sleep continuity at night, in addition to the alertness during the day, and to address their safety, to investigate their mood and ensure that mood has normalized. And patients may be stressed with work concerns or having had poor work performance before diagnosis, so addressing their social and financial health becomes important as well. So there are non-pharmacologic, non-drug treatments for managing excessive daytime sleepiness. In our apnea patients, first and foremost is to investigate sufficiently questioning the patient using rating scales to determine if there is, in fact, residual sleepiness. Patients are often relieved that they're improved and aren't really looking at the edges to be sure that they're optimized. Things that we can do from a non-pharmacologic perspective are to encourage weight loss, which does require good treatment of the apnea, as well as exercise and a good diet program. Alternative treatments can be considered other than CPAP as one treatment, which are positional therapies, which are appropriate when someone has exclusively apnea on their back, or what we call POSA, positional sleep apnea. And positioning devices can also be added to other therapies to optimize control when a patient does have residual apnea and they are, for instance, on CPAP and it's not fully managing the problem. There are oral appliances to improve upper airway patency during sleep. There's a hypoglossal nerve stimulator that's available for the treatment of sleep apnea as an alternative, and there are surgical interventions. In narcolepsy, we do have the option of using timed naps and scheduled naps, often brief in the duration of 15 to 20 minutes, to help improve alertness. And after a nap, patients may appreciate several hours of improved alertness. They do have to strategize doing that, and you may need to help them with the social aspect of that by giving them a note for work that they do need to take a nap and need a place to do that. Patient education on managing their own symptoms and optimizing their sleep hygiene. The pharmacologic interventions won't work if we haven't laid the groundwork of an adequate floor of sufficient sleep. It's also important to remember that there is a significant comorbidity between obstructive sleep apnea and narcolepsy. So if you've made a diagnosis of narcolepsy in a patient and they didn't have apnea when you started treating them, if it's 5 or 10 years into it and they're older now, readdressing that question can become quite important. Pharmacologic management of excessive daytime sleepiness in an apnea patient is often addressed once the apnea is fully addressed and there are residual symptoms. It does become important to question the patient, use the Epworth Sleepiness Scale and other rating scales to determine if their alertness has completely normalized. There is an exception, and that is the apnea patient who is so sleepy at the time of diagnosis that they are at risk of losing their jobs or having an accident. And in that case, the addition of pharmacologic interventions to manage the sleepiness in the apnea patient may be appropriate at the front end of treatment. And sometimes in those patients, it can be tapered off. And other times we're looking at the patient who is happy that the apnea is treated but does have residual symptoms. And treatments that are appropriate for obstructive sleep apnea do overlap with narcolepsy, and modafinil, armodafinil, and solriamfetol are all wake-promoting agents that are, in fact, FDA-approved for the management of sleepiness in both obstructive sleep apnea and in narcolepsy. Specifically, the treatment of sleepiness in narcolepsy is something that is usually managed early on once we've confirmed that the patient does have adequate sleep hygiene and is getting enough sleep at night and is sleeping on a regular sleep schedule. So social jet lag and a lot of variability in the timing of sleep can lead to a striking amount of daytime sleepiness and diagnostic testing that proves sleepiness, but it's due to circadian malalignment. So before initiating pharmacotherapy in your narcolepsy patient, we want to assure that those things have been managed. And we have, in addition to the drugs already mentioned, pitolisant, that is an antagonist of the histamine 3 autoreceptor for the promotion of wakefulness and manages wakefulness and cataplexy in narcolepsy. And both sodium oxybate and the low sodium oxybates, which manage both alertness and cataplexy. And there is the use of the amphetamine derivatives, which we may use to augment alertness at the end of the day from some of the short acting medications, always with the caution of concern regarding potential for abuse or dependency. Although in my patients with narcolepsy, I find I'm trying to convince them to take enough medication to manage their day. They're usually extremely hesitant about it. And in your patients, once you're using pharmacotherapy, you want to be thinking about their other risk factors. So if they have a cardiac risk factor, a history of heart disease, have had a stent or congestive heart failure, then the use of newer available low sodium oxybates may reduce their risk of other morbidities. Excessive daytime sleepiness takes a major toll on patients from a social perspective and career perspective as well. It is important that we try to optimize their therapy with the drugs we have, sometimes using medications in combination, particularly looking for medications that might have two different mechanisms of action to optimize alertness, and looking at the end of the day functionality with some of the short-acting medications when necessary. There is plenty of room for more development here. Only about 12% of patients when surveyed in 2018 felt that their narcolepsy was adequately managed in terms of the alertness. There's a huge gap in feeling better and feeling normal. And that's important to consider. And Dr. Lammers will be discussing new treatments on the horizon to manage alertness for these patients with both apnea as well as excessive daytime sleepiness. Other things to consider are the whole patient and life events. Some of these medications that we've discussed may interfere with the efficacy of birth control pills, including modafinil, armodafinil, and pitolisant, and this needs to be considered when we prescribe. And none of these medications have been given a clean bill of health for use during pregnancy. And we use timed naps and other behavioral strategies to help patients get through their pregnancies without the use of wake-promoting agents the overwhelming majority of the time for the safety of the fetus. Looking at the patient in a holistic way, from repeating your Epworth sleepiness scale and checking that their sleepiness is managed, to delving into whether they need an excuse at work to be able to take a nap, and ensure that they are using all the tools in their toolbox to appropriately manage their medication and to avoid complications from the medications.
Thank you for sharing your clinical expertise, Professor Emsalem. Now on to our final interview. Professor Lammers explores the emerging treatment landscape for the management of excessive daytime sleepiness in patients with obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy.
My name is Gert-Jan Lammers. I'm a neurologist by training, but dedicated to sleep medicine for many decades, and I'm currently medical director of the Sleep Wake Clinic of Sein in the Netherlands, and also professor in sleep medicine at the University of Leiden. We made quite some progression in treating excessive daytime sleepiness in disorders as narcolepsy and OSA. But still, there are quite some unmet needs, both requiring efficacy, but also requiring side effects. The newer treatments seem to be more effective, and those that are currently in phase 2 studies also seem to be promising to be more effective. But there is something we need to keep in mind, because up to now, most of the trials, but also in consulting rooms, there is the focus on the propensity to fall asleep as expression of excessive daytime sleepiness. This is reflected in primary outcome parameters such as the Epworth Sleepiness Scale or the objective outcome measure, the maintenance of wakefulness test. They only focus on the propensity to fall asleep. But we must realize that this is just one expression of excessive daytime sleepiness. Almost all patients also suffer from problems with sustained attention and other cognitive problems. They just are not able to perform properly. And for example, if you manage to reduce the amount of sleep during the day, but if this sleep is just replaced by wakefulness in which you are not able to perform, you're not really treating patients properly. Therefore, there should be much more focus in trials, but also in consulting rooms, on improving sustained attention and performance in patients as well. This is also advocated by patient groups. And I do expect that in future trials, and again, also in consulting rooms, patient-related outcome measures will be much more important, because in fact, it are the patients, in fact, we are, let's say, developing these treatments for. Yeah, we gained a lot of knowledge about the regulation of sleep and wakefulness in our brain during the last 2 decades. What we know is that the main systems involved in wakefulness are monoaminergic systems and acetylcholine system. And what's exciting is a more recent finding that there is a system called the orexin system, also called hypocretin system, that in fact orchestrates or coordinates the activity of these nuclei in the brain that use these monoaminergic transmitters. So many of the new substances are or do have affinity for one of these systems. That's the one option you have to increase wakefulness. But on the other hand, for many disorders, in particular for narcolepsy, the disturbed nocturnal sleep may add to the daytime problems. So for these disorders, it may be important to improve nocturnal sleep. And you all know the benzodiazepines, they are GABA A agonists, but they do not improve quality of sleep and they do not improve daytime functioning. But interestingly, it seems that GABA B agonists may improve nocturnal sleep and also may improve daytime functioning. So many of the more recent substances that are under study are focusing on the GABA B system. And then we may expect additional substances that act on the adenosine system, which is also important for the induced induction of sleep in the brain. When we go into more detail about substances that act on the monoamine systems, we have new substances like solriamfetol, reboxetine, pitolisant, and masendol. Solriamfetol already reached the market, at least in the United States, and also pitolisant reached the market. The other ones are still under study, and the substances acting on the orexin system are currently entering phase 3 studies. Regarding the GABA B agonists, you probably all know about sodium oxybate, and there are, let's say, adjustments for this formulation by other substances with the same properties, but also by improving the side profile effect by replacing sodium by other minerals that may have less impact on the cardiovascular system, and also controlled release substances that will prevent the need to take another nightly dose of these agonists. Well, to discuss what we are learning, let me go through several of the new substances that are available or currently in phase 3 studies. One of the main substances is solriamfetol that is recently on the market in the US, not yet in all European countries. But you can see that the efficacy for excessive daytime sleepiness is quite impressive. When you compare the results from trials with the other substances, it seems to be more effective. But as always with new substances, it must be proven in daily practice that indeed the advantages that have been shown in clinical trials are indeed also reflected in daily practice. But efficacy seems to be better than most of the others, and the side effect profile seems to be comparable. Then there is the pitolisant, what's interesting because it's more selectively acting on the histamine system. This has several advantages. The one advantage is that it may be effective when the classical substances that are more have more affinity for the norepinephrine system and the dopamine system are not effective. And other advantage is that you can combine them because of the different mechanisms of action, and there may be a synergistic effect. Let's say on a group level, in the clinical trials, we see there is not a real difference in efficacy of these substances, and therefore it's probably very attractive to combine them if, let's say, monotherapy itself is not effective enough. Then there is a new substance, reboxetine, that's more selective acting on the norepinephrine system. Up to now, it's only phase 2 studies, but the phase 2 studies are quite impressive. So let's hope this will be confirmed in large phase 3 studies and it will reach the market. Then we have the GABA-B substances, and what you see here are, in fact, modifications of the current sodium oxybate formulations that are available. And one modification in the lower sodium one is that there is a lower amount of sodium, which means that there is a lower sodium load when taking the medication, and this will probably have advantages regarding potential cardiovascular side effects. I have to add that currently there are only trials that show efficacy, and efficacy is comparable to the classical sodium oxybate, and we are still waiting for future data that indeed the side effect profile regarding cardiovascular side effects is indeed better as expected from the theoretical perspective. Then there is the controlled release of sodium oxybate. This substance has the advantage that you only need to take it once a night and not a second dose in the middle of the night. And the first phase 3 studies point to similar efficacy for controlling symptoms in particularly narcolepsy. Finally, point to new substances that are in phase 1 or phase 2 studies. One other focusing on the histamine system, that's semaglutide. There's a study going on that is to be completed by the end of this year. And then there's another sodium oxybate substance, valiloxybate, and there are just studies initiated in particular narcolepsy. So let's wait for the results and let's see if they are indeed even more effective than the current sodium oxybate formulations we have at hand. Regarding safety, we need to make a difference between side effects and potential long-term safety problems accompanying the substances we may prescribe. Regarding side effects, the most frequent ones reported are headache and nausea, and in fact, these are the most reported ones for all substances. For the wake-stimulating substances, there is in addition the potential for irritability and anxiety, and that's much less for the GABA-B receptors. For the pitolisant, there is another side effect that's much less often reported in the other wake-promoting agents, and that's insomnia. But probably when titrating up the dose slowly and not running immediately to the maximum dose, it may prevent the occurrence of insomnia. But you have to take into account that this is a relevant problem in the minority of patients prescribing pitolisant. Then regarding long-term safety, particularly for the stimulants, there is the potential of long-term cardiovascular side effects. There are not much data on it, but from the theoretical perspective, because they're sympathetic-mimetic, most of them, and they may induce a slight increase in blood pressure and heart frequencies, these are potential risks that we need to monitor. And for future treatments, it's very important that we focus on these. And one of the examples of an innovation in treatment is that the sodium oxybate is changed in a formulation with a low sodium content, and we hope that it indeed may show that it will lead to less cardiovascular side effects in the long run. And then we have to keep in mind that many of the substances we prescribe have the potential to be addictive. For not really clear reasons, in narcolepsy there hardly ever is a problem with addiction, but this may be different in OSA patients. Up to now, the trials, there are not real convincing indications that it may be a problem, but we need to monitor this daily practice of if indeed is confirmed that this will not be a problem.
Thank you for those interesting insights, Professor Lammers. Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on sleep-related breathing disorders at www.touchrespiratory.com.